Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This is the first talk back at the city centre after the 3 months of the rains retreat. And as I said earlier, the topic of the talk is equanimity. Someone asked me to speak about the path of practice. What do you have to do to develop equanimity? And equanimity has many facets to it, but it basically means to be able to keep the balance of one's mind through the ups and downs of life, of what we encounter in life, what comes into our life, and what leaves our life. And in fact, equanimity is, if you like, the highest state of mind. The fully enlightened one is completely equanimous with whatever comes and whatever goes, because they understand life completely. They understand about ups and downs and are not moved by whatever they encounter. In fact, in one of the chants that we do, we say that the fully enlightened one, though touched by worldly circumstances, never the mind is wavering. So this is really the end point of the path of practice. But as we progress along the path, we will have a taste of equanimity, of even-mindedness, of being able to hold our seat, not lose our balance, because of what we encounter. And we have to realize that this equanimity is an internal development. It's an internal development, which means that we are no longer swayed by what goes on outside. That doesn't mean we don't act and react, but we're not acting and reacting from a self-centered point of view. Now, in order to develop equanimity, one of the important things we have to realize is that every aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path that we develop, that we cultivate, contributes to the end result of equanimity. And so tonight I'd like to illustrate this by talking about the path in terms of the three divisions that we usually make: sila, samadhi, and panya. Sila being virtue or morality, samadhi being the development of the mind in meditation, and panya being the wisdom aspect that understands things as they really are. I'd like to show how each phase of the path, it's not that it's progressive, that you have to do sila first and then you move on to samadhi and then you do panya. We're cultivating different aspects of each of these parts of the path continuously. But when we're trying to develop this balanced mind, everything we do on the path contributes to that. When we think about a virtue, morality, we're thinking about developing good qualities, wholesome qualities, supportive qualities that help to make the mind strong, steadfast. A purified mind, purified of self-centeredness, greed and hatred, is a mind which is much stronger. The Buddha gave the simile of a mind full of selfishness as being like gold which is full of impurities. It's very brittle. It can't be worked into any kind of ornament until you take out the impurities. And then the mind, the gold, becomes very strong and pliable. It can be used to manufacture whatever shape you like. So the mind that is purified to whatever extent will be stronger and more pliable. And if you think about what we're trying to accomplish when we're trying to be equanimous, you might think that being pliable seems to run contrary to that idea, because pliable means that the mind moves or is bendable. But if you think of the image of something that is very brittle and contracted and tries to resist a force, it's more likely to break than something that is like plasticine, that is able to be moulded, like the reed that is soft enough to bend in the strong wind, compared to the oak tree that tries to resist the wind. So the pliability of the mind is one of the things that allows us to receive experience, to acknowledge the reaction that's going on, but to refrain from acting on impulse in response to whatever we receive. The mind that is trained in virtue, particularly the mind which is trained in restraint through keeping the five precepts, gradually builds up the resilience to receive experience, to take the deep breath necessary, to resist acting on impulse, and to then have the space in which to choose wisely what the response should be to this situation. I can't overestimate or overemphasize how important the five precepts are for giving us protection from our self-centered impulses. If we make a commitment to keeping the five precepts and actively cultivating their opposites, within the restraint that comes from keeping the precepts and the cultivation that comes from developing their positive opposites, in that space we will find tremendous pliability, flexibility, resilience, to not be broken by what we experience, but also not to be swept away by our emotions, which may take us into unskillful speech and behaviour. These five precepts are really our friends, our protectors. They warn us when we're getting into dangerous territory, where we need to be careful, where we need to think twice. And by committing ourselves to keep them, we practice again and again saying no to those selfish impulses until we wear them out, we weaken them, and we give ourselves the possibility of doing something differently. A couple of stories that illustrate just how important these precepts can be as protectors for us. Also illustrate how we can often develop unskillful habit patterns because we do something initially with intention, consciously doing that thing, and then we get good at it. And because we get good at it, we do it again. And it becomes easier and easier for that particular behaviour to manifest. And that's why it's so important to use the five precepts as our standards. If we are going in the direction of breaking the precepts, we need to stop and think, what's happening here? Where will this lead me? Not just now, but in the future. Not just for me, but for others as well. And the future doesn't have to mean next week or next year. It can mean at the end of this conversation. So let me give you a couple of illustrations. One was a very interesting story someone told me about when they first were married and they had young children and they were staying at home and they didn't have any money of their own. Their husband was going to work. Every now and again they would like to go and check out their husband's wallet and see whether there were any extra coins in the wallet. And if there were lots of extra coins, they'd just help themselves to a few of those coins because they told themselves, well, after all, it's my money too, and he'll never notice. There's too many coins in there. I'll just help myself to a few. And it wasn't that they wanted it for themselves, but they wanted to have some cash that they could use to go and buy something for the children. And so they got in the habit of looking in their husband's wallet and taking the money. And they never got caught. And they actually enjoyed that thrill of getting away with it and knowing that they had this little secret. They told me when the children got older and they went to work and they earned their own money, every now and again they would still go and have a look in their husband's wallet and see if there were any extra coins there and if they could still manage to take a few of those coins without their husband noticing. And they would still get that same thrill to think that they had this little secret. And then they told me only when they started to practice and to keep the five precepts did they realize what had happened. That they had started out with a conscious intention to get something, which they justified to themselves, but it had become a habit pattern. It had become a habit that they enjoyed. And they got carried away with it because they didn't need the money, but they couldn't resist looking in their husband's wallet and taking out what they thought they could get away with. Now, this is quite a mild example. But you can see that even in that situation, the person has lost the balance of their mind because they're caught up in doing something without even full awareness of what they're doing. And they actually said to me, you know, I could see afterwards that it did actually affect my relationship with my husband because I always had this little secret. I was always a bit on edge in case he caught me out. Or he might say to me, where did we get that? I don't remember that we had one of those. And then I'd have to think, oh, we've had that in the cupboard for ages. You just haven't noticed it. Or, oh, someone gave it to the kids. Didn't you realise? And they realised that there was not only the effect of having to cover up, but just the fact that they weren't being truthful with their husband. Now, a much more powerful example of how habit patterns unskillful habit patterns get started and then get stronger and become easier to do until they cause tremendous heartache for ourselves and others. There's a story I heard of recently where a couple were drinking and they got drunk and they got into an argument, and the woman in the couple got so angry with her partner, but she was so out of control of her behaviour that she picked up her little baby and started to batter her husband with the baby, not realising that it was a baby that she was picking up. She was so drunk and so overwhelmed by her anger at that moment that she was completely oblivious to what she was doing. The child received a fractured skull and brain damage. Now, the interesting follow-up for that was the comment that her partner made when this was reported. His reported response was, "Everyone's making such a big deal of this, but you know, she didn't mean to do it." Now we can ask ourselves, yes, she didn't mean to do it, but the result is this. This child has permanent damage. This is how we can lose the balance of our mind when we live outside guidelines. Of course she didn't mean to do it, but her behaviour had gone long past the point where she was actually aware of what she was doing. And we can say in that situation, well, what is the point at which she was still responsible for what she did? Was it with the first drink that day? Was it with the first drink that she had where she got beyond the limit, out of control? Was it the last drink the night before that led to the first drink today, which led to the one that took her over the limit? Can see how we can lose track of where we started and also where it will take us to. We lose the balance of our mind, and sometimes we lose it and it has terrible consequences for ourselves and for others. So if we can make a commitment to sila, and we can train the mind to resist our selfish impulses when they're not overwhelming, when they're still manageable, little by little, we can take control of our mind, take control of our speech and our behaviour. And long before we get to the point where we're out of control in a very drastic way, we can know danger. Be careful. Stop and think before saying anything, before doing anything, before going any further. So this is how practicing sila helps us to hold our seat. It's not that we're not going to be affected by things. It's not that we're not going to have any emotional reactions. Our old tendencies will still be there, but we start to rein them in. We start to train the mind, and we practice at saying no when it's easier, and little by little we develop that strength of mind, that pliability to receive what happens without overreacting or reacting in an unskillful way, because we've not only practiced restraining again and again, but we've also practiced cultivating the opposites. So refraining from harming and cultivating loving kindness and compassion. Refraining from taking what is not given and cultivating generosity and willingness to share. refraining from sexual misconduct, particularly committing adultery and interfering in established relationships, and cultivating contentment with what we have. Cultivating our trustworthiness, living up to our promises. Refraining from wrong speech, harsh speech, speech which is untrue. Telling stories about people and cultivating speech which is honest, speech which is kind, speech which is bringing people together. And refraining from using drugs and alcohol because they confuse the mind. They make it easy to break any of the other precepts, as we see through this story. And developing the mind in meditation, practicing mindfulness to become consciously aware of what's in our mind and what is arising in our speech and our behaviour. Now, the next part of the path is samadhi. And this doesn't just mean meditation. It means starting to observe the content of the mind before we speak and before we act. Looking to see what's going on in there. Maybe no one else knows, but we should know what's going on in our own mind. And if it's beneficial, encourage it, cultivate it. If it's not beneficial, then work to not feed it, allow it to cease. When we're cultivating the mind in meditation in order to develop equanimity, we have to know our own tendencies. We have to know what things does my mind need in order to stay more balanced. For me to hold my seat when the good things come or when the unwanted things come. Remembering that we can lose the balance of our mind because we get so excited and overwhelmed with what we want or what we're going to get, pleasant things, as well as losing the balance of our mind when unwanted things arise or when things that we want to keep are lost. So it's keeping our seat through the ups and the downs. And so we have to know whether we run towards greed and desire or whether we run towards ill will and anger. We have to know what's the appropriate medicine for our illness. And we also have to see what situations are happening in our life right now that might be pushing us further than we've been before, really making us struggle. So we might normally be quite peaceful or quite able to deal with hostility, and yet we find ourselves in a situation, for example, where we're in at work, where we're with someone every day and we have a hostile relationship with that person. And normally we get on well with everyone. Normally we don't have to deal with ill will and aversion. But in our circumstances now, that's what we need to do. So we have to know what is the remedy for the illness that we have, whether it's our own personal tendencies, our inclinations and our habit patterns, or the circumstances that we're in. And there's a very nice story from the Buddhist scriptures, a teaching that was given not by the Buddha himself, but by one of his enlightened disciples, Venerable Maha Moggallana, who was one of the two chief disciples of Gautama, the Buddha. And Venerable Maha Moggallana could remember his past lives. And he remembered that many, many lifetimes before, in another Buddha's dispensation, long before the present Buddha that he was living with, that Venerable Maha Moggallana had been Mara. Now, Mara in Buddhism is a being who is like a deva, a higher being, who is born according to his karma to occupy a certain position, a certain status, and that he has the capacity to influence others. That's one of the qualities that Mara has. And Venerable Mahamoggallana remembered that in this previous birth, when he was Mara, he'd been very jealous of the Buddha at that time, the Buddha Kakusanda. And he was very jealous because that Buddha was being praised and receiving all sorts of support from people. But he was also very annoyed because the Buddha was enlightened and there was no way that Mara could influence his mind, the Buddha's mind. And not only that, that the Buddha had taught many other disciples who'd also become enlightened, and Mara had no influence over their minds either. And so he was really determined to somehow outwit, if not the Buddha and his enlightened disciples, at least those who were still practicing on the path. And so he picked on a group of bhikkhus who he knew were still not fully enlightened. And he went to where those bhikkhus were living and to the villages where those bhikkhus were going on their alms round, and he started to criticise the bhikkhus to those villages. Look at those baldies spending all day sitting on their backside meditating. What good are they? What do you think they're doing? They tell you they're meditating, but they're no better than a cat who's sitting at a hole waiting for a mouse to come out. What do you think's going on in their mind while they sit there? They tell you it's really high and spiritual, but they're no better than a donkey that's been carrying a heavy load and has been unloaded at the doorway and who's just standing there with his head drooping, waiting to be fed. That's all they are. And Mara talked in this way to the villagers in that area, and so the villagers started to say, well, why are we feeding these monks? They're meditating all the time, and then they come round and they want some food. And so the villagers got very upset with the bhikkhus, and when they came, they very reluctantly offered them any alms food, and sometimes they even shouted abuse. And so the bhikkhus, knowing that this was quite a difficult situation, went to the Buddha and asked, what should we do in these circumstances? Should we leave? And the Buddha said, no, don't leave. Practice loving-kindness meditation. Deliberately send out goodwill to all the villages. They've been feeding you. They are looking after you. Don't forget that. Send out loving-kindness. And if you can't send out loving kindness, then find some compassion in your heart for them, because they're doing something that's really unskillful. So if you can't do loving kindness meditation, do compassion meditation. Send out the wish that they may be free of the anger that's making them so unhappy. And so the bhikkhus had to go away and practice this diligently in their meditation so that they could go on alms round and not be upset by what the villagers were saying to them. And as they continued to practice, they were able to remain equanimous and ride out the disfavour of the villagers. And so Mara got very upset. His ploy hadn't worked. He hadn't been able to get into their minds and overwhelm them, because he knew the only way he could really get in and do any damage to these bhikkhus was if they lost the balance of their mind. Then there'd be an entry point for him to come in and make things worse. And he was very unpleased with the fact that he hadn't been able to upset the bhikkhus by abusing them. And so he took another tack. The next ploy was to go and tell the villagers, these bhikkhus are just wonderful. Did you notice that they didn't get upset? They didn't call you names back. They didn't abuse you. They didn't even leave. Aren't they wonderful? They must be such advanced practitioners. We should really offer them whatever support they need. And so, of course, the next ploy was to praise the bhikkhus and offer them the choicest foods, the very best that they could offer. Anything that the bhikkhus needed, that's what the villagers would like to provide. And of course, Mara was hoping that through the praise and through the gain that was being offered to the bhikkhus, that that would unsettle their mind. And of course, the bhikkhus recognized, oh, this is a temptation. Now they think we're wonderful. And they could feel themselves losing their seat through inflation, inflated egos. And so they went to the Buddha and they said, what should we do now? Now they're praising us. Now they want to feed us all the best food. Now they want to give us everything that they think we need to support us. How can we keep the balance of our mind? And the Buddha said, when you see that delicious food that they want to offer you, when you smell that odour that's so tempting, when you taste the delicious food, remember where it will be tomorrow. Where will it be? Now, some of it will be in the body, making blood and hair and eyeballs and all sorts of things, but a lot of it will be in the toilet. And when you look at that food, when you smell that food, when you taste that food, just remember where it will be this time tomorrow. And in that way, don't allow the desire for that food to overwhelm the mind. And when you hear those sweet words of praise, and when you receive those wonderful things that people are offering you, remember, this too will change. This too will pass. This too is impermanent. Keep the recognition of impermanence foremost in your mind. Praise and blame follow on. First there may be praise and then there's blame. First there may be blame and then there's praise. But all of it is impermanent. None of it is substantial. And so the bhikkhus had to practice looking at that food, reminding themselves of that food as not just nourishment for the body, but as waste products. And they had to remind themselves when they heard those words, impermanence, impermanence, change. And as they practiced, they were able to maintain the balance of their mind. Because they were able to maintain the balance of their mind, there was no entry point for Mara to do further damage. Now, this is actually a very deep teaching about equanimity. It's not that we're not going to react, but when we react and we have practiced to receive that experience as it is, to recognize its nature, we don't respond in a way which is unskillful. We may temporarily lose the balance of the mind, but we don't get overwhelmed. We don't let our reaction flow out in our speech and our behaviour. And the more that we practice to strengthen the mind in meditation, to calm the mind and purify the mind, remembering that we're also purifying the mind through sila, the more we will be able to be pliable, be flexible, but not lose our seat at that time. And this brings us on to the wisdom aspect, the punya. In developing equanimity, most crucially, we have to recognize that change is inherent in everything. Everything that arises passes away. Sometimes we love that. We love something when it's not nice to finish. Something that's unpleasant to be over. It's not that we don't like change. We actually thrive on change. Sometimes someone was talking to me today about boredom. Boredom arises because nothing changes, because things that we have to do just are there all the time and we don't actually like them. And so we want change to happen. When something happens, even if it's unpleasant, it's at least something different. So I gave the example of seeing a car accident. It's unpleasant, but it's stimulating, it's change, it overcomes boredom. So it doesn't even have to be pleasant for us to think that it's better than nothing happening. So change is part of life, and if we can really work with that, if we can remind ourselves of it, if we can watch for it in the pleasant and unpleasant, the wanted and the unwanted, then we will be able to keep the balance of our mind. Things that come will surely go. Things that we are experiencing won't last forever. This can help us to get through very difficult times when we think, if this is all it's going to be, I can't stand it, I can't bear it. But if we remind ourselves that this too will pass, then very often it gives us the strength to go on just this moment, just this moment, just this moment, to abide with things until they do cease. That doesn't mean that we don't do anything. If we can do something to help in a situation, if we can do something to get through a difficult time faster or more skillfully, we do it. It doesn't mean that we become passive and indifferent. But if we are able to maintain the balance of our mind, then we have a much better chance of being able to recognize what we can change and do something about it, and what we can't change and learn to live with it. So the wisdom aspect is, first of all, to recognize change. This is really crucial. And as we recognize change, we start to see what makes change happen. Causes and conditions are constantly in a state of flux and flow. And a change in any cause or condition can affect the totality of something that seems very solid, that seems fixed, that seems unchanging. Very often we hear of people saying, my situation is like this, and I can't see how anything's going to change, or I can't make that other person change the way I want them to. So in that situation, we recognize that we can change our attitude. We really only do have control over ourselves, and sometimes that's only very limited. But what can I do with my attitude towards this situation, towards this person? And just by working on that, even if we can't change the outer conditions, that will have an effect on the total situation. So people who are good practitioners and who are dealing with very distressing situations, either very poor physical health, life-threatening illnesses, or people in their family who have mental illness or who have addictions, and that other person isn't going to get better or isn't going to change, or for the person themselves, their health isn't going to improve. Just by working on their own mind and their own attitude without changing the outer conditions can make a tremendous difference. So we start to identify the different strands that make up any particular situation. And once we change our attitude and we become more equanimous, we can very often see things that we couldn't see before, that we are willing to patiently work on, whereas previously we were impatient and we wanted an immediate result. As we work patiently, we might find that a change in one attitude does affect the other person. No guarantee, but it certainly does happen. As we start to identify how causes and conditions produce any situation, any experience, causes and conditions within ourselves, our own mind, our own habits, our own emotions, as well as the outer conditions, we start to understand one of the most important teachings that help us to develop equanimity. And that is the teaching on karma. I am the owner of my karma. I am the heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. We start to see how we're creating our own life, creating our own reality through the choices that we make, through the decisions that we make. When we make a deliberate choice, mentally, vocally, through our actions, we are creating karma. And that action, whether it's mental or verbal or physical, will produce a result that will be in accordance with that action. Very often we lose the balance of our mind because we don't like what we've got in our life to deal with. And we might say, well, where did that come from? I've never done anything like that to create that kind of result. And sometimes we can't see where things come from, but we can see what we're doing in this moment. How can I act in this moment to make this situation better, not worse? And sometimes we lose the balance of our mind not because we want our situation to be better, but because we want someone else's life to improve. Particularly people that we love, people that we're attached to. So parents want their children's life to be better. Partners want their partner's life to be better. And particularly if there's, as I said, addiction or mental illness or physical health that's not good, we really can be very distressed and unbalanced because we would just like their situation to be different. But each of us is the owner of our own karma. Each of us is on our own individual journey. And though we interact and though we affect each other, it's the choices that each one of us makes that produces the results. Of course, there will be other circumstances which affect, can ameliorate, change, modify the situation. But ultimately, we're the owner of our own karma. And this is particularly important when we're seeing someone that we care about suffering and wanting their suffering to end. The result will come from their own thought, speech, and action. And sometimes keeping the balance of our mind means just being open to be as supportive as we can, to guide them as best we can, but not to take on responsibility for their situation. We can lose the balance of our mind and get into blame, get into guilt, get into a feeling, I should be able to help them, or I should have been able to stop them, or I should have been able to make it different. And so the more we practice, the more we get to see the limits of what we can do. And the more we start to recognize where our ability to do for another ends and where their responsibility starts. This is an extremely crucial teaching. It's not that we abandon those that we can't help. It's not that we turn away from doing what we can do, but we recognize that each one of us is the owner of our own karma. And if we can see how in our own lives the choices that we make create our reality, create our life in this moment, moment after moment, then we start to recognize how this is true for everyone. And also we start to recognize what we can do to create the kind of life that we'd like for ourselves. So keeping precepts is one of the ways that we create the kind of life that we'd like for ourselves. We live, we become, we are the kind of person that we'd like to have as our own best friend, as the person closest to us. We become that person. As we develop the mind in meditation, we develop a mind which is truly our good friend, which is able to remain balanced in the ups and downs and to help us to get through the things that we in the past have lost our mind over. And as we continue to work with this again and again and apply the teachings in our life, we start to develop experiential understanding of the Buddha's teaching, the wisdom aspect, the truth of impermanence, the truth of not being in control of the things that we assume to be mine, this body, for example. We start to recognize causes and conditions, cause and effect, as a process that we're all part of. And then we become able to be more discerning about what ingredients we put into our life in order to get the result that we'd like to have in our life. So as I said at the beginning, equanimity is actually the result, the high result of practicing this path. For the fully enlightened one, there's complete equanimity. Those of us who are still on the path walking towards that goal, we touch equanimity at times. We develop, build on the equanimity that we've gained, and we see the results of our practice through the equanimity that we're able to sustain through the ups and downs of our life. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to hold our seat through the ups and downs, and may it help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them. I forgot to tell a story which is really helpful for the idea of change, and it's also very appropriate for this location because it's a story about the AFL Grand Final, which some of you probably took some notice of. And you'd be aware that this year's Grand Final, football Grand Final, was played by the same two teams as played the last year's grand final, 2005. And a lot of people were making much of that and commenting that this year's grand final would be a replay of last year's grand final and that it might have the same result. And I was very impressed to read a comment that the coach of the West Coast Eagles, John Worsfold, made when he said, "It's not the same grand final, it's this year's grand final. Maybe the same teams playing, mostly the same players, some different. Might be the same venue, might be the same big event, but it's a different grand final. There are lots of changes that have happened since last year. The experience of playing in the first grand final is one of those factors. The experience that we've had in the intervening year, which players are free of injury this year, which players are reaching their peak, all of those things make this a different grand final, this year's grand final. And I thought that was very wise, and it's something for us to reflect on, that whatever we're meeting in the present moment, whether we think it's a replay or a repeat, is actually different. Even if it has a lot of the same characters, a lot of the same conditions, it's this moment, this time, it's different. And we're different. Whatever we've experienced in the intervening year means that we're different now, with a different catalogue, if you like, of experiences from that time. So this is something that's a good reminder when we find ourselves trying to replay an old event, to remember that it's this year's event. And just to add to that, I was also very amused to find, to read, that there were some thousands of people who were actually watching last year's grand final on television without knowing it. They'd switched on to a channel that was not able to broadcast the grand final this year, so they were replaying the 2005 grand final. And people watched it without realising that it was last year's event, until some of them were listening on their transistor radio to the commentary on the radio and finding that it didn't quite match up to what was happening on their television screens. And then they realised that it was last year's event. And again, this is very, very good for us to reflect on, because we often think it's last year's event because there are so many things that are similar. And we think that we know what we're doing. We think that we've got it all sorted out because we've been there before, we've done that before. And it's not. It's different. So if you keep these examples in your mind, you get an idea of how change, which is so obvious but can be so subtle, that we're actually trying to recreate something that has long ago passed away. And that's one of the things that unbalances us. We're trying to make this thing be what it was instead of dealing with what it is right now. So, any comments or questions? Well, I think that's enough then.